IOX is supported by Catskill Mountain Cleaning, specializing in Airbnbs, vacation homes, and private residences. Cleaning, firewood stack, trash removal, and small pest exterminating. Serving the Catskills region, including Margaretville, Andes, Bovina, and the surrounding area. More information at 607-261-1674 or CatskillMountainCleaning.com. WIOX is supported by Tito Bandito's Catskills Taco and Tequila Bar, Mexican food and cocktails, margaritas and craft beers, indoor seating and takeout, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Tito Bandito's Catskills Taco and Tequila Bar, Main Street in Pine Hill, under the same ownership as Binnekill Tavern, the Swiss-German restaurant in Margaretville. Reservations at 845-254-3113 or titobanditos.com. WIOX is supported by Rick's Tire Service, family-owned and operated on State Route 30 between Roxbury and Grand Gorge. Tires, mounting, and wheel balancing for cars, trucks, lawn, garden, farm, and construction vehicles. Open Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, Saturday, 8 till noon. More information at 800-LG-TIRES, 800-LG-TIRES.
Hi, this is Susan Shaw.
And I'm Alan Vella.
We go to New Orleans on All That Gumbo every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6.
And you are listening to WIOX Roxbury.
Live and local in New York's Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20, and WIOXRadio.org.
Okay, you are listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and everywhere at WIOXRadio.org, where it's easy to donate if you like what you hear. You can also get WIOX on any smart device through the Radio.fm app. This is From the Forest, every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John, how's it going?
Things are good. Spring has sprung.
Spring has sprung. It has. Yeah. What have you been up to?
Oh, yesterday cut some trees, released some apple trees, but I took notice of aspen flowering and willows are flowering, so that was nice to see.
That's nice.
That's nice.
Yeah.
That's my official stamp of spring when I see woody vegetation flowering.
True. Yeah, we're releasing apple trees as well, but... No, I'm just firewood, basically trying to replace what I burned.
Yeah, that's what I've been doing on my off time is firewood.
That's right.
My goal is to be done, which I will be, but I always am. But it's always my goal to be completely done before I break a sweat.
Before you break a sweat?
I mean, like, yeah. I don't want to be out there doing firewood at 70 and 80 degrees.
Yeah, I know it. So. I know it. Yeah, as long as it's done before May or the halfway through April will be nice. And just in time to mow the lawn. Hey, I saw a guy mowing his lawn in Andy's today.
What? What was he mowing?
I don't know, man, but he was mowing some grass there. He was cutting the grass.
That's awesome.
Yeah, just uphill by that farm as you leave 28 going uphill towards Delhi.
That is awesome.
Yeah, take a look at it on your way home.
I'm going to pass by tonight, yeah.
So on the left-hand side going uphill, guy's mowing his lawn. I'm like, come on, man.
Yeah, that's jumping the gun. Because see what it does? It sparks a reaction. Like there's a catalyst here that begins the neighbors. Last year, I did it. I broke it. Right.
Broke the seal.
I broke the seal, and then literally 2 hours later, my neighbor is like, well, I guess I better do it. He jumps on his mower and starts mowing.
That's right.
And that's how it happened. So that small strip in Andy's there is going to be all mowed down the next week now.
Well, apple trees are starting to burst here, the buds, going from, I guess, well, silver tip to green tip. But someone who knows way more than me about this is Peter Jench, and I got to ask him how to say his last name, but it's What's Eating My Apple? The Growing Impact of Wildlife on Growing Apple. And our speaker tonight is Peter Jench. He's a station director and senior extension associate, research and extension entomologist at the Hudson Valley Research Laboratory, which is part of Cornell University in Highland, Ulster County. And Peter focuses on palm fruit, small fruit, grape, and onion. He also focuses on efficacy of newly developed pest management tools for invasive insects and native insect pest complex, employing strategies and a cost-effective, environmentally sound approach, provides fruit growers with the knowledge to improve insect pest management strategies. He also has a blog, Jench Lab blog site, a lot of good information on there, and let me see if I can get him on. Peter, are you there?
All right, how are you?
I'm fine.
Sounds good.
Hey, how do you say your last name before I butcher it again?
Yeah, well, you did a pretty good job. It's Jench.
Jench.
It's a Y. Mm-hmm.
Got it. All right.
From the old country.
No kidding. So what have you been up to?
So just like you, we've been out in the orchards and watching things grow. You know, we're looking at all kinds of different varieties. Was over at Angry Orchard. They have a site near Walden, and they have a lot of cider varieties that they've put in the ground. They've taken a lot of the old varieties out, the old standard varieties, you know, Stamen and Macintosh, and they've done a lot of grafting over, leaving the old trees in place, and grafting on a lot of these French and English varieties right into the trunks of the older trees. And on one side, they might have one variety, and on the opposite side, they put in a different variety. So things like Dabinet, Masters, just varieties that either bloom really early, you know, so we're seeing a lot of green tissue on those varieties, or they bloom really late. And so a lot of them are still in dormancy. So that creates all kinds of issues with regards to pest management, but it sure is nice to see some green tissue out there.
Yeah, I was surprised, Peter. I went down the hill. I just have a little orchard behind an 8-foot fence, and some of them were green tipping out, and I need to ask you about that tonight. So, but we'll get to that. But what got you into all this stuff? What got you into fruits?
Well,
and, yeah.
I, you know, when you're a kid, it's amazing the influences that are the ones that direct you in things that you're just become passionate about. So one of my passions as I was a teenager was drawing. And I loved art, loved drawing, loved looking at things and trying to copy them. And so I decided to go to school for wildlife biology and forestry. And the very first class that I went to was an entomology course. And so the very first thing that the professor only did, he sat us behind a microscope. He gave us a selection of insects and said, put these under a microscope and start drawing. And that was it, that right there in a nutshell. Fell in love with insects, the complexity of insects. So I didn't pursue forestry. I ended up getting into entomology instead. Even though I ended up with a degree, an associate's degree in in, you know, conservation and natural resources for Morrisville really was my my beginnings. And I have to say, that type of education for my personality type was just what I wanted, just what I needed. Because we were doing everything from welding to rebuilding engines, ripping apart chainsaws, constructing pole barns, you name it, plumbing. And so that landed me a job. Once I walked in and walked into an office where Dave Rosenberger, who is our plant pathologist, was working, he basically said, "So who are you? What do you do?" And I told him that, you know, I own a Volkswagen bus, just got finished rebuilding the engine for the second time. And I was pretty much hired on the spot. And I ended up being sort of a renaissance guy where I did all of the maintenance on tractors, oil changes, you name it. But I also did a lot of the biology. So I started writing grants. I ended up getting a bachelor's degree in education and a master's degree in entomology over time. And next thing I know, I'm the station director at the Hudson Valley Research Lab. So long story short, I really enjoyed my last 33 years.
33 years, wow. Yeah,
yeah,
that's great.
Crazy.
Now it says you went to school in Nebraska?
So that's where I got my master's degree, but you know, they had these distance education programs.
Yeah.
So by the time I pursued that, I had my daughter on my lap, you know, and I was staying up until midnight, 1 o'clock writing papers, and I did all of that work via distance ed to the University of Nebraska. And so for those of us that are working and have a family, it was a great way to get a master's degree. My predecessor, Dick Straub, who was a vegetable entomologist, was retiring. The university said they were no longer hiring PhDs at the outlying stations like the lab, and so having a master's degree was just what I needed to be able to fill his shoes and continue with the research that we were doing there together.
So, Peter, maybe explain what the Hudson Valley Research Lab is. I don't think a lot of people up in the Catskills aren't familiar with it. I tell them about it all the time. But if you could just outline a little bit.
Sure. So in 1923, so the roaring 20s, right, there was a lot of money to be had. The Geneva Experiment Station basically was taken on by Cornell University. And at the same time, the governor of New York commissioned Cornell to send three scientists down to the Hudson Valley because the growers at that point in 1923, they were using lead arsenic, there was all kinds of resistance to cotton moth, all kinds of problems that they were running into. They assigned a horticulturalist, a plant pathologist, and an entomologist to the region. And so for about 40 years, they were a bit vagabond. They jumped from one lab to the next. And while they were in Poughkeepsie in the late 50s, they had a fire in their lab, and the growers on the west side of the Hudson River got together and they said, look, why don't we just build a building so we can house these guys, we can set up a lab for them, and we'll have them right in our backyard. So that's what they did in 1963. They completed the lab. In 1973, they doubled the size of the lab. And from really 63 until now, there's been Cornell faculty in a apple grower owned and operated building. So it's a partnership between Cornell and the Hudson Valley Research Lab Incorporated. It's run by an 11-member board of directors, and their mission really is to be able to have research done in the Hudson Valley that pertains to the kind of varieties, the kind of climate, the various production systems that we have in the Hudson Valley. And it's been, for the growers and for Cornell, just a really great partnership.
Yeah, I just thought it was so practical. I've gone to a few things, and I've always learned something there. Really practical knowledge and stuff.
That's really the bottom line for apple growers. They want to know what's going to work and when to make it work. So that's what we focus on.
Go ahead, John.
I was going to ask, are these orchards like members of the Hudson Valley Lab to, you know, gain access to this information, or is it all it's all free?
Free. The members, the grower members, probably get more out of it than, you know, the general public. You know, so we take every call that comes in, anywhere from, you know, why are there stink bugs in my home and how do I get rid of them, to, you know, when should we be looking at applying an insecticide for cotton moth emergence. You know, so we get very specific with the growers We provide them information. We hope that it's going to be really applicable, you know, 5, 7, 10 days away from when they actually need to do it.
Yeah, I mean, having someone that can properly diagnose and offer a treatment in an orchard setting or any fruit tree setting is just, I don't know, that's so important, I would think.
Yeah, it's certainly helpful for the growers, and we're finding more and more people who are backyard orchardists, people who like heirloom varieties. They're all intrigued with trying to grow apples on their property. And to be perfectly honest, everything under the sun, from diseases to insects to mammals, we have bears wandering through picking apples where I live here in Rosendale. Everybody wants to eat the apples.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to keep them on the tree. You can do a good job of controlling insects and diseases right up until August. And then the birds and the woodchucks, you name it, turkeys come flying in and decimate the crop.
Everything wants to kill them. You ever notice the bears? They go right to the top and dismember the tree. It's terrible.
and that's where the old standards come in. You know, if you have an old Macintosh that's 30 feet tall, you know, those fruit are eventually going to rain down, and you'll be able to turn them into sauce and cider, and you'll have quite a few to eat, you know. But they produce hundreds of apples, and, you know, even the squirrels, the gray squirrels, can't take them all. So those right. bigger trees are nice to have.
Yep. So if you're just tuning in, this is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., and tonight's topic is What's Eating My Apple? With the growing impact of wildlife on growing apple with Peter Jentsch from the Hudson Valley Research Lab. So why the Hudson Valley? Why was it? Why was Hudson Valley chosen for the research lab by Cornell?
So it was really imposed upon Cornell by the governor. And so it is an interesting region because we're considered sort of the banana belt, you know, of the state. Along with, I mean, there are places out in western New York, Finger Lakes, where they also get a lake effect, but the Hudson River really has a tremendous influence on the ability for hillsides along the river. We have an Illinois Mountain Range, we have the Shongum Ridge, and then off in the distance, the Catskills. But a lot of that air drains down into the Hudson River, and it allows for a place for the cold air to settle. And so those hillsides then kind of create an inversion, if you will, pulling warm air down while it displaces the cold air, almost like a vacuum pulling in something above it. And so those hillsides are idyllic for growing grapes. And back in the late 1800s, the Hudson Valley along the river was primarily grapes. And then once, you know, various things happened with regards to climate, there was a number of new settlers that moved in. Many folks from Italy came rolling up the Hudson Valley from Manhattan and New York City at that time and started planting apples, and they also had grapes. But, you know, there was a transition, and so apples do really well, for the most part, pears especially, in cooler climate and well-drained soils for air, as well as well-drained soils, the alluvial soils that they have there created by the glaciers, just for water drainage. It's really, really a perfect location. And really the settlers that moved in, you know, during the 1600s, moving up into the Hudson River Valley, you know, they played a huge role in bringing agriculture up to the region.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are surprised about how important apples are to Ulster County, right?
Oh, yeah. It's been like that for quite some time. Now, if you look at the three major growing regions in New York, we have the Western New York, Lake Ontario growing region, so there's a plateau along the lake. It's nearly idyllic for apple production. It's flat, sandy soils, again, lake effect, you know, so there's this warming trend, and there's two different elevations. So you do get a gradual drainage of the air, cold air down toward the lake, and then you get that inversion similarly to what we have in the Hudson Valley. Then you have the Lake Champlain region. They grow quite a few apples in the Hudson Valley. So Lake Ontario probably grows three-quarters of the fruit in New York, Hudson Valley, and Lake Champlain region sort of split the amount of fruit that we have. The interesting thing about the three regions is not just the varieties, but, for instance, in Lake Champlain, they grow some of the best Honeycrisp in the world. It's very cool there. and Honeycrisp, which is a very popular variety these days. It's got that snap and sort of blast of flavor that people are enjoying. It's idyllic climate there for that. In the Hudson Valley, you know, we have a real diverse mix of varieties, and because primarily we have all these different production systems. You know, we have pick your own that has just taken off over the last 15 years, where people come. And instead of growers harvesting for retail market, where they've got to move the fruit off the farm, people come directly to the farm, harvest the fruit off the trees. And so the profitability, the margins of profitability are very, very high. And then we have, you know, traditional retail and wholesale as well. So those different production systems really do diversify the growers here in the valley and reduce the amount of competition really between them.
So let's get right into it, Peter. Tree fruits. Which tree fruits do well in the Hudson Valley without, what's the low-hanging fruit, for lack of a better way of saying this, out of all of them?
Yeah.
The stone fruit, the palm fruits, you know what I mean?
Right. So the people that are growing stone fruit, primarily peaches, apricots, nectarines, They're very, very difficult to grow. They are very prone to various types of diseases. Management for them is precarious, and the weather is really precarious. You can make a lot of money on peaches and apricots and nectarines if you can grow them, but most growers that have peaches in the ground, and cherries, will throw them in the mix as well. They're not successful every year. Apples and pears are very successful year to year because, one, you can control the crop. You can manage the crop load, and so you have return bloom every year, and your crop load is fairly consistent from year to year. It does very well in cold conditions. They're fairly resilient. And there's been lots and lots of changes with varieties. You know, so if you were to look at varieties of apples, you know, if I were to throw out a poll to your listeners, you'd have a huge range of what people really like. So the diversity in a pick-your-own operation, for instance, is really important. Some people like the old heirloom. Other people like really tart. Other people like really sweet, everything in between. And so diversity of apples allows you different timings. Pears, usually very late in the season from early August with Bartlett on into Bach and some of the other really flavorful varieties in the mix. Pears are relatively straightforward to grow. And we can get into management of pears in a little bit, but they really just have a couple of insects that cause problems and really just, one or two diseases that are problematic. So it's just keeping the return bloom in pears, but they're fairly hardy. They usually give you a crop every year. So the low-hanging fruit really are the varieties that are falling out of favor in the market. You know, McIntosh used to be a huge apple in Lake Champlain. Now, you know, they're ripping out all the Macs and putting in more and more Honeycrisp because people find Macs too soft and have changed their taste, really. And that's what's creating, these constant shifts of variety. And it dates way back, to the early 1900s when growers are still looking for, what's going to be the best new variety. We're still doing that.
As far as insects and diseases, is there one that's less so than another, pears, apples, stone fruit?
So if you could control plum curculio, which is a beetle that comes out, if you have apples, most people understand the nature of this beetle. It emerges usually during bloom. By the time the fruitlets get to five millimeters in diameter, the female comes in and begins to create a scar with their mandibles. So they've got this really long sort of snout. It's a snout weevil. And it creates an incision in the fruit. She spins around. She tucks an egg into that. The egg hatches as a grub, burrows through the fruit. During that burrowing time, the apple starts producing ethylene. The ethylene, the alcohol, basically causes an abscission layer on the fruit, and the fruit drops to the ground, which we call June drop. And it's a natural event as well as an occurring event by plum curculio. And you can lose 100% of your crop every year from that one beetle. If you could control that one beetle, you're most likely going to have fruit at the end of the season for the birds and the bears. And everybody else.
Right. I have a problem with pears in my. I have heavy clay. All right, it stinks.
Right.
And pears seem to be more tolerant of that poorly drained site. I won't even look at stone fruit there. And the apples do okay if I put them on the very driest sites of those.
Yeah.
What am I doing wrong? I mean, what now? Since I've been doing dormant oil and stuff, I've been getting better luck, but I don't know if it's just correlation or causation. But I don't know. I feel like I had leaf hopper damage and stuff, but, you know, a lot of it is the site. I'm not sure.
Yeah, so the perennial occurrence of wet feet, that usually causes a root problem. The disease oftentimes that causes the problem is called Phytophthora. And once you get soggy soils and the roots don't get the oxygen it needs, right, so you need the aeration of the soils, clay, unless it dries and wets and dries and wets really, really frequently, if it stays wet for long periods of time, it just succumbs to that heavy presence of that disease, and it just can't get enough nutrients. You know, it can't get enough oxygen. You know, the soil moisture is just too high. It sort of suffocates the tree. Then, typically what happens is trees go into stress. And when trees begin to get stressed, they also produce ethylene. And other insects cue into that. There's a beetle called the black stem borer. It's an ambrosia beetle. And it will enter into the tree and create a gallery, and they'll feed their young inside the tree. And it could be a real problem, you know, with regards to the tree's response to that. A lot of trees shut down. Some of them just die right off. So there's... In soils that are heavy clay, what you could do to alleviate some of the stress is to create berms. You know, so you put the tree up higher than the ground level, and that might mean bringing in soil that maybe, you know, is from a different location possibly, or something a little more loamy rather than just clay, and then have it on a mound so that a lot of the water just runs off. And
yeah.
The roots can permeate down into the clay, and it's probably not going to get, you know, it's going to get more aeration.
I agree. Even taking, I did some drainage and stuff, and that did help.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
The stuff that was we took out of the, you know, the ditches we made and made a mound of, man, that stuff grows really well, anything I put on it. So,
yeah,
I don't know.
The loam.
Yeah. But
high organic matter, you know, a lot of plants really like that, that sort of compost mix of soil.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know, with the new plantings that people are putting in, you know, there's very little attention paid to, you know, really feeding the trees and focusing on the soils. A lot of the trees that are grown on the Illinois Mountain Range, It's mostly in shale soil, so it's a loam, but toward the knolls, you know, you have the outcroppings of shale, and they'll take the tooth, you know, behind the tractor and just sort of plow into that shale and create places for the trees to grow, and they do really well until it gets droughty, and then they undergo stress, and they succumb to, you know, various other illnesses as well as, you know, black stem borer, but... You know, when things are well, when we get adequate rainfall, those trees in well-drained soils just do extremely well.
Yeah, they have like do they have like drumlins or some kind of glacial feature down there in Highland Lloyd and stuff? It's
yeah,
different.
There's unique features. You know, most of the soils along the river tend to be really alluvial, like lots of large stones. But then we have this fragipan that runs underneath that alluvial till that's all clay.
Yeah.
You know, so some sites just have alluvium, others have this interface, you know, and then where the water drains through really well, hits that interface and then comes out in springs almost, you know, during the rainy season. So, you know, it can be problematic.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is What's Eating My Apple? The Growing Impact of Wildlife on Growing Apple with Peter Jentsch. He is the station director there at the Hudson Valley Research Laboratory in Highland, Ulster County. So let's talk about pest of pome fruits. Let's get into that because the show is flying by. We're already 30 minutes in.
Yeah, well, it could be here all night. So the thing that really drives, you know, as much as I point out Plum Curculio being the primary pest of apples for most homeowners, the driver of apple production pest management is the diseases. And if you go out into the orchards now and you see sprayers out there putting something on the trees, right now they're putting out oil to take care of mites and San Jose scale, and they're also using that as something of a spreader sticker to apply copper. And the copper is put out primarily for whatever remnant of apple scab that was left from last year. So the leaves that were infected from that disease are now the spores are maturing in these small packets, and they're sending out spores little by little this time of year. And by putting out copper, you're killing off that fungus. Along with the fungus is another disease, which is a bacterial disease. It's Erwinia amylarvo. It's fire blight. And that really devastates apple trees. So by having the copper on the tree, when the infections that occurred last year begin to ooze from the cankers that were created during the infection last season, then that copper hits those oozing pockets of bacteria and kill off the bacteria. So that's why they're spraying now. But if you look through the season, it's really the diseases that drive the sprayers, if you will. Hmm. And early season, for certainly varieties like Macintosh and many of the others that are susceptible to apple scab, and then many, many varieties that are susceptible to fire blight. So those really drive the pest management all the way through what we call second or third cover, which is, you know, probably 4 to 6 weeks after bloom. Then there are late season diseases that are more superficial. But during bloom, we have then the rot organisms come in while the trees are flowering. And again, you know, you're going after something like black rot, brown rot, different organisms, fungal pathogens that will go after the flower, get into the calyx end. And then during the season, you'll see these brown blotches, and those are caused by rots that occurred during bloom or slightly before. Cedar apple rust, you know, as a forester, you know, the eastern red cedar is an alternate host of that pathogen. So cedar apple rust in year one would be on the cedar tree. Eastern red cedar have these galls that are formed, and when it rains, the galls sort of explode into these almost alien-like teleohorns that come out of these circular globules. and then the spores are spread by rain and wind, and they land on the trees. Even resistant trees to apple scab, like Liberty, is a disease-resistant apple that sometimes succumbs to small brown blotches on the leaves that are caused by cedar apple rust. But other varieties, like Gold Rush, for instance, a variety that's really popular for cider production, that the apples just get completely riddled with either quince rust and or cedar rust during the season. So those diseases are the biggest problem with regards to being able to get apples at the end of the season. The insects, as I said, we have 15 different insects that just go after the fruit. Early in the season, you know, we're trying to control the eggs of European red mite, and then the scale that sometimes gets blown in from along the perimeter, San Jose scale, pernicula scale in some cases on stone fruit. And then as you move later into the season, there's a hemicran insect. They have a piercing and sucking mouthpart like a straw, and they suck that sap right out of the developing cluster. So now what we're seeing are the little mouse ears opening up. They're, you know, if you're looking at some of your apple clusters, you might be seeing the development of the fruiting buds. And so tarnished plant bug on a day like today and tomorrow and the next day where it gets up to 70, they start emerging. They go in there and they'll start feeding on those buds. And when they do that, the results of that are these almost like belly button type how would you call it? It's almost like a puncture in the apple that grows around that feeding site. So it looks like a belly button. And so that throws apples out of grade. Then we've got Plum Curculio. oblique banded leaf roller is a worm that feeds on apples during bloom. So these next few weeks, it's just mayhem.
Would you say this is one of the most important time for like maybe a backyard orchardist or orchardist to be paying attention?
Absolutely. Okay. I'm not, you know, there's lots of people, there's lots of resources of information, but from now until the end of bloom, if you do a really good job of controlling diseases and insects right until the fruits start to develop now, you could almost walk away and get a really good crop. However, the inverse is true. If you neglect this period of time, especially just before bloom, just after bloom, you know, during that bloom period, you're most likely going to lose the majority of your crop.
So, Peter, let's you know what? I've been getting questions from members at the Catskill Forest Association asking me about should I spray with dormant oil on copper right now. But before that, let's back up for a second because I think this is confusing to people who aren't as familiar with apple tree stages. Can you describe what dormant is, green tip? These are different stages that tell someone when they're reading the label and knowing when to spray.
Sure.
Can you describe that?
Yeah, it really is an important concept. So when the trees are going through the winter, the buds are very, very tight. You don't see any cracks in the buds, and there's no pubescence showing in and around the buds for the most part. And then as we move into the early stages of spring, as you guys were talking about earlier, you know, it's nice to see those willows blooming. When we start moving into the season, we begin to see the buds start to crack open a little bit. And the pubescence of what we call silvertip starts to show. And we call that stage a delayed dormant. So it's a little bit after dormant, and it's when you begin to see the first signs of bud development, but just before you see green tissue. Now, why is that important, really, between, you know, knowing these early, early stages? Well, the green tissue that begins to appear, and everybody should be seeing it now for the most part in, you know, the mid to upper Hudson Valley, even into the Catskills on the early varieties, ones that, you know, begin to show it. That green tissue then becomes very susceptible to apple scab. So if you have a tree that's susceptible to that disease, then on days when we have a rain event, those spores that are in the last year's leaves will begin to ejaculate, if you will. They get thrown up into the air and taken by the wind, and during a rain event, they'll land on that green tissue, that tiny little bit of exposed green tissue in the bud, and it will begin to grow. So the fungus, basically the spore, begins to put out a hyphae. It's like a root, and then it enters into the tissue, usually through a spherical or some other access point on the leaf, and then it'll begin to grow inside of that tissue. And once it begins to infect the tissue, then controlling it becomes much more difficult. So now the reason we put on copper is to act as a prophylactic, you know, a little bit, just even a few molecules or ions of copper will kill off that developing spore and keep it from infecting the tree. So that's where the separation is really between delayed dormant and green tip. Now, once we move from green tip, we head toward what we call tight cluster or half-inch green. Before we get to tight cluster, and half-inch green is when you see green tissue on 50% of the buds that haven't opened up yet. So the leaves haven't curled out, and you can't really tell their leaves. It's just an extension of the green tissue inside the bud. Then from half inch green, we move to tight cluster. Tight cluster is when those little tiny leaflets begin to separate out, and you begin to see the inside of that bud, which are the flowering buds there. And so as that begins to open up and it gets to a place where those leaves are well-defined, they're horizontal, and those flower buds become very visible, that's tight cluster. And then when you begin to see the next stage, which is called pink, the flower buds will then enlarge and show you the red color of what the sepals are going to be in and around the you know, the petals. And so it goes into a pink stage. And then of the five flowers that are in a single cluster, the one in the very center is called the king. And the ones around the king are called the laterals. So when that king begins to open up, we call that king bloom. Usually when we say it's open, it's 50% of the phenology of that event. Like 50% of all the clusters are a tight cluster, 50% are a king bloom. And so we use that term to give us a little more definition in knowing how to go about management as we move forward. Once that king opens up, it's really all bets are off with regards to the use of any insecticide that would have any impact on bees. And so then management becomes a little more difficult for pests that haven't been controlled up to that point.
Right.
So that's just the beginning of the season.
So, Peter, I went down the hill, and tell me if I screwed up. And, you know, I'm noticing, because I have all different varieties, that some are, from what you described, delayed dormant, some are green tip, and some are opening up like a quarter to a half an inch, right?
Right.
Is it too late to do some dormant oil, copper? What's the deal? Because I get asked this all the time every year, and I can never retain the information.
Yeah, well, this is kind of a fun part of the season because it's really easy. It's just like, well, do I or don't I spray dormant oil and copper? That's the only option you really have right now.
Right.
And so the dormant oil-copper combination, as I mentioned earlier, the oil has some vitality as insecticide. However, you would need to use it at least at 1%. So that means a 1 gallon per 100 gallons or, you know, whatever the ratio would be for a much smaller container.
Yep.
And that 1% then would cover the eggs of European red mite or of some of the aphid species. And once it does that, once it puts a layer around that egg, the respiring egg, like the egg needs oxygen at this point with these higher temperatures. It can't get the oxygen, and so it perishes. And so that's the whole idea with 1 or 2 or 3%. The higher percentage you have, the longer the residual lasts on the tree. However, the downside is if we get cold temperatures like we had, was it last Friday?
Yeah.
We're dropped down into the low 20s here in the Hudson Valley, probably into the upper teens where you were.
Yeah.
We then put the trees at risk for burning those leaves, especially in those low-lying areas where the cold air really settles in and stays for a long period of time. So that's the problem with oil. We had, you know, starting yesterday, we had idyllic weather for making an application yesterday, today, possibly tomorrow into the early part of the afternoon, and then we're expecting some rain. But, you know, you can still get an oil and copper spray on now. So that's what the oil will do. But copper, most coppers that you're going to apply are what they call fixed coppers. They're very, very stable. And so they release copper ions very slowly. And so the copper ion basically is that tiny component that's going to kill the disease, whether it be bacteria or apple scab. And by putting this out, it remains residual on the trees until we get, you know, an inch and a half, 2 inches of rain, and then it's pretty much all gone. But during that time, during the rain event, is where you really need it, because that's when the infection is going to occur.
I see.
Right? So you can still get that on. Just look at the weather. You know, we're at a point where we have more tissue, so we want to back off on the oil. We definitely don't want to go to 3%. You might want to go to 1% or maybe 1.5%. And that'll still get you the eggs that you're looking to kill or the scale that you're looking to kill off. And it'll also act as a means by which to hold on to that copper for a little while and help with the redistribution of it, which is really critical, you know, as we move through these small rain events.
Yeah, because I'm reading the label last night, and it says, you know, delayed dormant for oil. And it says do not spray below 40 degrees. But then, you know, you got to know that the forecast is. And then I read in other places, other extension services, and they say you should spray when you feel the lows are comfortably in the 40s. Is that accurate?
Well, Uh-oh. You know, so not to, I don't want to throw stones here, so please don't take me the wrong way.
No, no.
But the people that write the labels and the companies that sell the product and use the label as the law, right, they want as much buffer as possible, right? So 40 degrees is as comfortable as it gets. You know, you're just not going to see any injury there. The closer you get to freezing, 32 and even below 32, it then it depends on how long it's at that temperature, what's the sustained really low temperature, and all those have an impact on whether or not you're going to see some phytotoxicity to those developing leaves. So it's very safe. You know, it depends on how much you want to gamble. And the growers tell me all the time, yep, that's all I do is gamble with the decisions they make. You know, if you feel like you don't want to take any risk at all, then 40 degrees is a really comfortable place. Most growers are spraying. If they're above 32, they feel perfectly comfortable putting that oil on.
Yeah, but it's not too late. It's perfectly fine. Like tomorrow, I'm going to go spray some dormant oil and copper. Is that all right, you think?
So the earlier varieties that have a lot of tissue, by putting copper on those now, you may see a little spotting of the leaves.
Russet.
Now, it depends on how much copper. So I would lean towards sort of a lower rate of copper.
Yeah.
And maybe on those varieties, I might not even use the oil. Just go with the copper.
Okay.
Because, to add another layer of detail, oil is a solvent, right? And light dissolves light. So oil dissolves things that are oily, like the cuticle of a leaf. So the oil is going to get on that leaf. It's going to start to dissolve that little bit of cuticle that it has on there. And then the copper ion is going to get into the leaf. And if it gets into the leaf tissue, it kills the leaf tissue. So that's why they really want you to apply copper and oil at dormant or even delay dormant. Now that we have green tissue, you might want to hold off or forego copper altogether, depending on how those varieties that you have in the ground, how susceptible they are to russet and to phytotoxicity. Right? So you kind of have to know your varieties a little bit as well. If you really wanted to be cautious, I'd probably hold off on going with the copper at this point. And I'd only put those on the varieties that are now showing a lot of tissue.
Okay.
Because by the time we get to tomorrow morning, you're going to be like, wait a minute, how much good growth did we get overnight here? I mean, these things, you know, it's warm now, so they are going to keep growing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, is russeting, is it that bad?
Well, so if you're just consuming your own fruit, you're going to eat right through the russet. It's not going to be not that big a deal,
right,
really. If you're making cider, it actually has no impact to speak of, other than, you know, you're going to get that surface russeting. It might inhibit growth a little bit on some varieties. And, you know, it's more cosmetic. But I have to just back up a little bit. On the foliage itself, those developing cluster leaves, you want to be able to have those be as pristine as possible moving forward. You don't want them to crinkle. The more they crinkle, the less photosynthate they create because of the variability of the leaf surface. And so that's, by doing damage to those cluster leaves, you're reducing the viability of the fruit moving forward, you know, the creation of that carbohydrate for fruit development. So, you know, those are all considerations that are really hard to work around, you know, because it almost keeps you from doing anything, you know. So on the later varieties, you know, they're still not showing a lot of tissue, you know, going out and putting copper and oil, and you'd probably be fine.
Okay. So basically, do oil on pretty much everything. It's not going to harm them as long as the solution's somewhat lower in dosage.
Right.
And copper on only the ones that are in delayed dormant or dormant.
Yeah, that would be a good recommendation.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, if you're going to get some russet, if you get some spotting of the leaves, a lot of that is already in, you know, what I'm seeing in some of the orchards in the low-lying areas is those early leaves just got hit with some colder weather. You know, the temperature's down into the teens and into the 20s while that leaf tissue was developing. You know, it got hit a little bit. And so those leaves are going to be compromised even without putting anything on, right? So you know, let's just keep all that in mind and try to make the best decision you can. It's not as cut and dry as we would like when it comes to these decisions.
And last question on that, do you ever recommend, I mean, you can't be as accurate if you're going to do this, mixing oil and copper?
Yeah, no, most people mix oil and copper. So anytime you have a liquid, you want to add that last. You always add the wettable powders and, the dry ingredients first. You get them into suspension and then come in with the liquids. Yeah. And if you're going to add oil, always add oil last. If you have more than, one other material in the mix. There's lots of growers that are putting in, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 different products in the tank. Poof, it gets a little hairy, but that's what they do.
And, some members are asking me about surround kaolin clay. What do you think about that?
Right. Yeah, kaolin clay is a hydrophobic compound. It's amazing stuff. We've used it in lots and lots of trials. If you want to grow pears and you want to have the least amount of pear silo on your trees from our studies, we ran kaolin clay as the surround WP formulation. We would put that in at 50 pounds to the acre. So in order to mix that in, basically a 7-gallon bucket, you add water to it, pour the material in, get a cordless or a corded drill with a paint stirrer on that, get it into solution, pour it into your tank, and off you go. Some guys down in Pennsylvania for pear silo use surround and oil together. I prefer to just have surround in myself, and then after petal fall, then come in with a 1% oil every 2 weeks, and the trees aren't going to be clean of silo, but you're going to have the best fruit you can get and the lowest number of silo on the trees with very little sooty blotch on them. So that's a program I feel really comfortable with. On apples, for plum curculio control, it works pretty well. You're still going to see, 10, 20, 30, 40% injury from curculio, but it's really the best organic material we have as a standalone. You can certainly add Entrust to that or, some of the other. I'm not wild about Pyganic. I really don't think it's that effective. But the Surround plus Entrust does a pretty good job at reducing plum curculio injury, using an organic program.
Before I forget, so when do you recommend then, so you don't have russeting, to introduce copper back into the mix? Which stage then?
So you probably want to then use it later into the season where the fruit have developed. And you're going to use copper for summer diseases and rots. And that would be, sometime, I believe, around late June into July is when I think copper would be used. The copper is going to produce blackened lenticels on the fruit. It's not going to change the flavor. It's just the aesthetics of the fruit are going to be compromised. And if you rotate copper and sulfur alternating, on a 10-day, two-week program during the summer, depending on the weather, that gives you decent fruit with low incidence of summer rot. Yeah. And that program is used by a lot of organic growers.
Amazing. A lot to know. Believe it or not, if you're missing the show, tonight's topic is What's Eating My Apple? The Growing Impact of Wildlife on Growing Apple with the Hudson Valley Research Labs, Peter Jentsch. Peter, we only got about three or four minutes here, but what is something you wish people knew that perhaps they don't?
Well, for the homeowner, somebody who has two or three or four or five trees in the backyard and they just want some fruit and, they want the grandkids to make cider with them, at the end of the year. It's a really great reason to have apples. If you can control plum curculio early in the season, just focus on, that one organism, that beetle at pink just before bloom, and then right after bloom, just as those fruitlets start to form, you're off to a great start, and just keep curculio out because that's one of the reasons you're losing all your fruit. And then the only other thing on top of that is try to take fruit off the tree. Most trees are just have an overabundance of fruit. And then when we get into June with so many fruit, the tree does not begin to develop buds, fruiting buds, for the following year. So you've got to take those fruit down. The use of Carbaryl, you know, or 7, that's sort of a homeowner product, that will help to reduce the number of fruit on the tree. You've got to reduce the number of fruit on the tree, as illogical as that sounds, in order to get fruiting buds the next year, or else the majority of trees go into what they call biennial bearing, which means lots of fruit one year, no fruit the next. Lots of year, you know, lots of fruit the following year, none the next. So you want to be able to have a consistent crop load year after year, and you've got to take those fruit off before the 1st of June. And that's really the calendar point at which you have to get that done.
Well, we'll see. I might gamble and spray a little copper tomorrow, Peter.
I think it's worth the risk, you know.
All right, that's what I like.
We don't have cold temperatures really to speak of coming up, and you know, I think you're going to be okay.
Yeah, I'm going to do it. It's just a matter of whether I mix them or not.
Yeah. Yep. Well, you could decide that when you wake up.
That's right. Tomorrow's, I think, is going to be good. It's not going to be windy. It looks like a 5-mile-per-hour wind, so it'll be good.
Yeah, no, the morning looks great.
Yeah. All right. Well, Peter, thanks for coming on tonight. I really appreciate it. And I wanted to mention, what's this blog site you have? Because there's a lot of good information on there, too, right?
Yeah, sure. It's the Edge Blog. You know, I usually put out, if you want to subscribe, I put in there usually every week, an update on what's happening in the world of insects, and I've been including a little bit of diseases and various other things. So, you know, it's likely that, you know, people will get something out of it, you know, in terms of where we are during the season and how to, you know, how to control some insects that are really important.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can subscribe, you can always unsubscribe, and then, you know, you can go back through the messages. There's historical phenology data. There's all our reports, you know, going dating back to like 1973. You really got nothing to do. And then there's lots of, you know, video and use of organic materials, like I mentioned earlier, for pear control and apple control. You know, it might be worth your time looking at that.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for coming on, taking the time, and have a good night.
Yeah, you too, Ryan. My pleasure.
All right.
We'll
thank
see
you.
See you soon.
Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. If you just missed the show, that was Hudson Valley Research Labs, Peter Jentsch. And, you know, Peter's awesome. He knows a lot.
Very thorough. I had at least 8 questions written down. I couldn't get to one of them.
No, I had more, too. I'm sorry, John. We could have gone for another hour for sure.
Absolutely.
But next week, tune in from the forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Take it easy.
Good night. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way. Getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, did appear upon his mantle shining the face of one so dear who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games in an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town where the river runs down from the forest. With a mighty roar, big jet soars above the canyon streets, and the con men con, but life goes on, for the city never sleeps. And to an old forgotten soldier the dawn will come.